How do you respond in the midst of a crisis? I read a story of a young couple that got married, and they were completely different personalities. The wife was a bubbly, happy-go-lucky person who was always sharing everything on her mind. The husband was much quieter. He was much more focused. In fact, he would often find himself caught up in a task when his wife would come in and have something she wanted to share, and often it led to an argument. They sought some counseling, and eventually the counselor recommended that the proper course of action would be for any time the wife had something to share to enter the room and wait until the husband was ready. And then once he was ready, that he would stop what he was doing and give her his full attention and listen to what she had to share. It took a little getting used to, but it seemed to be working pretty well. One afternoon, the husband was in the garage working quite intensely on a project when his wife bounced in the room and got his attention. He held up his hand just for a second and went back to work, and 3 or 4 minutes later, he was finally at a point he felt like he could stop, and so he looked up to her, and she said as calmly as possible, "The house is on fire." The reality is that there are times in which a calm demeanor maybe isn't the proper response. Or is it? If you have your Bibles, would you go with me back to the Gospel of Luke? We're making our way through this incredible story written by this medical doctor as he explains to us the man who was God. This morning we find ourselves in chapter 8 of the Gospel of Luke, and as we come to chapter 8, we're going to find ourselves in the very midst of a storm, and we're going to see how the disciples respond to the storm. I will admit, all the way through this course, as we've been going through the Gospel of Luke, I have been trying extremely hard not to go back and show pictures from Israel. It was February of 2009 that I was told that I was going to get this incredible privilege to go spend 2 weeks in the Holy Land. And the second of the 2 weeks we spent in Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem it was this hustle and bustle, this small area in which thousands or millions of people gathered. But the first week we were in the northern part of Israel, in a place just outside the Sea of Galilee. And along the shore of the Sea of Galilee, we stayed at this incredible place. And this place had some amazing views. It was called the Pilger House. It was a German place that had been built by German monks. And we had a chance to literally be on the very coast of this Sea of Galilee. The views were amazing, and we would walk down almost every morning to have a Bible study down there. And one of the more meaningful times was the last day we were there. We actually celebrated the Lord's Supper right on the Sea of Galilee, right where Jesus and His disciples undoubtedly had eaten many meals. But one of the things you notice when you get there are these boats, these pilgrims, they call them, these tourists that go throughout the Sea of Galilee. And on Wednesday of the week we were there, we had a chance to get on this boat. And we got on the boat, and as soon as we did, pretty much everybody grabbed their cameras and they began to take pictures of the things that we had seen from the land. Now we were suddenly get to see other things. Somebody decided to take a little nap, but most of us, we just looked at the amazing scenery. We came to this site, which is Capernaum, the ruins of Capernaum, and it was from there that Jesus set out, and we headed to the Gadarenes, and as we did, the professor who was leading the trip stopped and read this. "One day Jesus said to his disciples, 'Let's go to the other side of the lake.' So they got into a boat and they set out, and as they sailed, he fell asleep. A squall came down on the lake so that the boat was being swamped, and they were in great danger. The disciples went and woke him, saying, 'Master, Master, we're going to drown.' He got up and rebuked the wind and the raging waters. The storm subsided and all was calm. 'Where is your faith?' he asked his disciples. In fear and amazement, they asked each other, 'Who is this? He commands even the winds and the waves, and they obey him.' And for about 15 minutes, we sat in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, and we contemplated that question. Who is this man that even the winds and the waves obey him?" For the 20 minutes or so we have left this morning, I want to consider that question. If you want to outline it, I came across a message by John MacArthur, and I like his outline. I'm going to steal it. It's the calm before the storm, the calm in the storm, and the calm after the storm. A very simple outline, but the storm is an amazing storm. And Luke begins simply by saying one day. He evidently has broken the chronological order with the story of the family. If you were here 2 weeks ago, we looked at the light, and then followed by the story of the family, which Matthew and Mark actually puts before the parables. And so, probably because he's broken the chronology, Luke just simply says it was one day. If you go back to the Gospel of Mark, he sets the context a little more intently for us. This particular day was an important day because it was the day that Jesus began speaking in parables. Up until this point, Jesus was speaking very clearly, the Sermon on the Mount, the Sermon on the Plains, in which Jesus clearly laid out the qualifications necessary to enter the kingdom. But as he was rejected by the Pharisees, he switches to speaking primarily not in clear terms, but in parables, which are stories which require great energy and effort to understand, which, in essence, hide the truth from those uninterested, but reveal tremendous truth to those who are willing to work. And Jesus begins to teach. The parable of the sower was the parable we looked at a couple weeks ago. The parable of the light, and in Mark's gospel, several other parables. And we know that Jesus begins teaching in the morning, and it is now nighttime. I know some of you have a chance to do teaching, and somebody told me that an hour of public speaking is about the same amount of energy level as an 8-hour job for most people. I don't know if that's true or not. But if you've ever had a chance to speak for 3, 4, 5, 10, 12 hours, you might begin to understand the physical fatigue that Jesus was experiencing. He was tired. And so he says to his disciples, let me just stop there for a second. Who are the disciples? I don't know if your mind works the way my mind works. I hope for your sake it doesn't. But my mind, as soon as I hear the disciples, I jump to people like Peter, James, John, Andrew, Bartholomew, the two Judases, and so on. Are those the disciples? Well, if you jump up in chapter 8, you'll see that Luke tells us that when Jesus traveled from town to town and to the villages, another proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God, the 12 were with him. I would suggest in Luke's account, the 12 are what we normally think of as the disciples. The disciples and the 12 are not synonymous. A disciple was simply anybody who followed Jesus. In fact, many of the disciples didn't believe in Jesus. If you were here last week, we went back to John chapter 6 and John chapter 7. In John chapter 7, we read the story of how Jesus' brothers did not believe in him. But chapter 6 concludes with Jesus saying that anybody who wants to enter the kingdom of heaven must partake of me, must believe in me. And it concludes by saying many of his disciples left him. In fact, I would argue that on the day of crucifixion, many of those who had once been a disciple of Jesus were standing in the city of Jerusalem crying, "Crucify him." A disciple was simply one who followed Jesus. Some of them followed Jesus to see the miracles. If you go to Las Vegas or you go to Branson, both places have huge magician shows. That you can go and you can watch this person do some things that your head tells you he can't do, and yet your eyes show you that he can do it. And we know that it's just some illusion, some sleight of hand. But imagine if you had a chance to go and watch somebody have a man who had his arm swiveled up and simply says, "Be healed," and an arm grow back. Somebody you knew had never seen anything, and he simply talks to him, and he's now able to see. Somebody who has never said anything can speak. Somebody whose body is consumed by leprosy, probably having parts of the body gone. And Jesus simply touches him, and all the parts regrow. Wouldn't you be a little curious to watch? In fact, the multitudes came out and were following Jesus, but not necessarily believing in Jesus. I don't know everyone's heart here this morning, but just because we name ourselves as Christians, just because we come to church on Sunday, doesn't mean we are a believer in Jesus Christ. That's a heart issue, not a feet issue. Many followed Jesus, but followed him for all the wrong reasons. And what's really interesting, and this really changes my mind of the disciples, do you know that when Luke describes the disciples, he says the 12 were there, and oh yeah, by the way, there were women there. There was Mary Magdalene, there was Joanna, there was Susanna. And so if you come back to this picture of Jesus is going to tell the disciples to go get in the boats, I am convinced it's not a male-only crowd. It is a mixed gender crowd. In fact, we know from Gospel of Mark that there was more than one boat. It says, leaving the crowd in Mark chapter 4, leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boats. We know that it was Peter's boat from Mark's Gospel, and so we know it. Well, we assume that at least Peter was there. If his boat was going, most likely he was as well. But there were other boats. There is this small armada of boats with, I would suggest, men and women headed across the Sea of Galilee. And as they're headed across the Sea of Galilee, he falls asleep. The only place in the Gospels in which we are told that Jesus slept is in this story. It's told in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and so it's not just in Luke where it says he slept, but in this story alone, Jesus slept. Does that say anything to you? To me, it's important for at least two reasons. The first is because Jesus was human. Our 21st century scientific-based worldview tends to come to the story of Jesus and has very little problem with his humanity. I mean, after all, we have records of people seeing him, hearing him, touching him, probably smelling him, I hope not tasting him. But we have stories of people who came and saw Jesus. And we have multiple records of it. And so we as 21st century science-based mindsets have very little problem with the humanity of Jesus. Now, the deity of Jesus, that's another story. We struggle with the idea that somebody who is human can also be divine. In fact, a couple groups that call themselves Christian deny the deity of Christ. And they would claim that Jesus is not God, but rather the first of all creation, that he is this really great guy, but he's not really God. And many in our society really struggle with his deity. In the first century, they struggled with both. I mean, let's face it. Somebody who can speak and the waters listen to is not a normal person. Somebody who can speak to somebody who's been dead for 4 days, that's not normal. The person who did the things that Jesus did, the person who could bring himself back from the dead, is not normal. The early church struggled as much with Jesus' humanity as they did his deity. In fact, as you come to the second epistle of John, John's second letter, written towards the end of the first century. John was most likely the last of the gospel writers. Scholars tell us that he wrote the book of Revelation and the gospel of John probably in the 90s. We're not entirely sure when he wrote the letters, but probably later than most of the other letters. In there he says this, many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. Many were saying that Jesus was God who looked like a man but wasn't really a man. He wasn't human. He just looked human. In fact, there was a whole teaching in which said anything flesh is evil and spirit is good. And thus, obviously, God couldn't come as flesh because that would have made him by definition evil. And John says that if anybody comes with this teaching and they've gone out into the world, any such person is the deceiver and the antichrist. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not take him into your house or even welcome him. Don't accept anybody who denies the humanity of Jesus. I don't think we think enough about the fact that Jesus was a person just like you. Jesus got tired. Jesus was exhausted. I don't know what your busiest day is, but imagine your busiest day and at the conclusion when you're wanting to get some sleep, you still have thousands of people not allowing you to sleep, but demanding your attention. And the only way that you can get away is to literally get on a boat and to go where they can't follow. And that was Jesus' normal life. And he gets on the boat, and what happens is he collapses. I meant to include a picture, but I didn't. But they have found a first century boat, and the first century boat is the only thing that has left, the only physical evidence of what a boat looked like. The boats of the first century were not the boats that you saw us in, the 30 or 40 foot boats that could house 20 or 30 people. They were probably 10 foot boats. They probably comfortably had maybe 6 to 8 people in them. There wasn't a downstairs bedroom with its own bathroom like you see in the yachts today. Jesus most likely got on the boat and absolutely collapsed. We're told in Mark's account that he finds a pillow and he goes fast asleep. And then the storm starts and he sleeps right through it. Jesus understood what it's like to be tired. Jesus was fully human. And it is only because of his humanity that he is able to die in our place. His sacrifice was necessary for God to come as human, just like you and just like me. But there's a second thing that really struck me. This week has been a really different week for me. If you were here last Sunday, I shared that the doctors came in and said that my grandmother probably wouldn't make the day. In fact, they told my parents over last weekend that they were trying some medicine. They weren't very optimistic, but if it didn't help by Monday, they were going to stop the medicine. And so on Monday, they took her off all fluids, all medication other than some pain medication to make her comfortable. And they were expecting her to pass away on Monday. So I redid my week and I came in on Tuesday and got all ready for my message this morning. And by Wednesday, I was completely done with my message, fully expecting to go up to the Twin Cities on Friday, Thursday and Friday. My week normally is I spend Friday and Saturday in my office studying. And so I wanted to get it all done. So I was ready. Well, she didn't pass away till Friday. And so I went into the office on Friday and I was a little out of sorts. I don't know if you're a creature of habit. I'm far more of a creature of a habit than I care to admit. And so I was suddenly, what do I do now? I am not sure what I should be doing. And I came across an article written by a pastor that I've heard speak several times by the name of C.J. Mahoney. And he was sharing the theology of sleep. Do you struggle with sleep? The older I get, the harder it is to get a good night's rest. The more difficult I have getting 8 hours, 7 hours, 6 hours of sleep. And so I was kind of curious. So I listened to this message and he talked about the blessings of sleep. What an incredible gift it is from God. He talked about a number of things of sleep. And then he made one comment that really struck me. God asks us all to sleep about a third of our life, at least in part, because there is no greater demonstration of my trust in God than sleep. Can you protect yourself while you're asleep? Hurricane comes. Are you going to wake up? We have fire alarms in our house. And you know those things that are supposed to go off and wake everybody up? Last summer, during one of the rainstorms, lightning struck close enough to our house to set the fire alarm off. And ours are all hardwired together, so if one goes off, the entire house is going off. And so I jump out of bed and I run around expecting to see the house on fire. But after a few minutes not smelling smoke and looking all over, not seeing any damage, I was struck by the realization that no one else in my family was awake. Renee, I believe, was awake. So let me rephrase that. None of my children woke up. You have no guarantee that if a storm came tomorrow night that you would even wake up. What happens if you have a heart attack, a stroke in the middle of the night? You've got no control. Sleep is this incredible demonstration that God, I am not in control. You are. And I have to be honest, it's hard some nights laying in bed with this problem or that issue, this needing to get done and that needing to get done, to allow my mind just to stop long enough so I can drift off to sleep because I'm trying to solve all of the world's problems and God's saying, hey, I got it for the next couple hours. Jesus knew what lay ahead. He knew he was going into a storm. He knew he was going into the worst storm the disciples had ever seen. And yet he is completely sound asleep. I think that's an incredible testimony of his willingness to trust his Father. What is it that keeps you up? Are you able to give that to God? Or do you just need to hold on to it a little bit? Jesus falls asleep, and as he's sleeping, we suddenly find this incredible storm. And Mark, or Luke rather, describes it as a squall came down on the lake. The Sea of Galilee is the lowest lake in the world as far as sea level. It's 700 feet below sea level, a fresh body of water, I should say. And as it's 700 feet, if you noticed any of the pictures, it's in a bowl. In fact, scholars are concluding that the word Galilee actually means bowl. And it speaks of these hills that are on either side. And what often happens is this incredible geography that makes for these sudden storms as the air cools, the depth of it sucks the cold air, the warmth of the sea pushes up hot air, and it's very common for storms to simply come out of nowhere. In fact, it was fascinating. It's much different there than here. Normally, I expect at night the wind to calm and to slow down. On the Sea of Galilee, almost every night the wind picks up and blows harder as you've got this convection of the cold air from around dropping down on the lake and the warm air rising. And so it was not at all uncommon. In fact, anyone who had made their living on the Sea of Galilee would have been involved in numerous storms. But this was a storm unlike what the disciples expected. As they take off, it's probably about 6 miles from Capernaum to where the Gadareans were, where they were headed, where we will get to next week. As they're going across this lake, in the middle of the lake, suddenly they're caught in this incredible squall. Mark calls it a great squall. Matthew calls it a sea quake. It is this incredible deluge as the boat is being drenched with water. And as it comes down, the boat was beginning to be swamped, and they were in great danger. And the disciples went and woke him up and saying, "Master, Master, we are going to drown." I don't know that I can fully get my arms around that. These are experienced seamen. These are people who grew up on the sea, who have undoubtedly been in hundreds of storms. How bad would it have to be for them to be convinced life is ending? Luke is kind. There are probably 10, 12, 14, 20 people there, and my guess is as they came down upon Jesus, they said different things. Mark translates it this way. "Teacher, don't you care if we drowned?" Be honest. You ever came to Jesus like that? "Don't you care that I'm going through this horrible storm in my life? Don't you care that I'm facing these horrific things? I thought you said you loved me. Where are you when I need you?" Jesus awakes. That's kind of interesting. The storm couldn't wake Jesus. But the comments of his disciples could. As soon as they came to Jesus, he's awake. And he simply got up and he rebukes the wind and the raging waters. The word that's used in Mark is the word he hushed. If you have kids, my guess is there's probably been at least one time in which your kids were playing their music or the television louder than you think they should. And you enter the room and you say, "Can you turn that down?" And they don't hear you. So you yell it louder and they still can't hear you. So they finally hit the button and suddenly all the music is gone. And they say, "What?" And you say, "Thank you," and walk out of the room. No, I don't know what you say. But that moment where all of a sudden this loud volume of music is just gone. Jesus hushed. Not just the winds. I mean, that's an amazing feat in and of itself, to think that he could simply speak and the wind would stop blowing. But it's not just the winds that stop blowing. The waves stop waving. You ever been in a lake where you drop a rock in the middle of the lake? You've got 14 miles to go. These winds have been blowing for at least enough time to swamp the boat. How long would it take that wave to stop? No time if Jesus is talking. The disciples fully understood what had just transpired. You could go back to the Old Testament and you can begin to see just these numerous places that say that only one can control the weather. In fear of sounding too politically incorrect, I am a bit amused by our generation's fascination with climate control. Now, I believe God has put us on this earth to care for this earth, and we, of all people, need to be caring for the environment and the things around us. But the idea that somehow my activity can somehow stop the winds and warm the planet or cool the planet. Who do I think I am? Psalm says, "You answer us with awesome deeds of righteousness. So God, our Savior, the hope of all the ends of the earth and of the farthest seas, who formed the mountains by your power, having armed yourself with strength, who stilled the roaring of the seas, the roaring of the waves, the tumult of the nations." One more in Psalm 89, he says, "O Lord God Almighty, who is like you? You are mighty, O Lord, and your faithfulness surrounds you. You rule over the surging seas. When its waves mount up, you still them." The disciples fully understood there is only one in all the universe that controls the weather. And that is God Himself. And suddenly we are left with this whole idea that in fear and amazement they asked one another, "Who is this?" If you grew up in the 50s and 60s, my guess is that you spent at least some time of your childhood watching a program. It was first on the radio and then was black and white. It was always set in the West, and it had this gentleman who rode around on a white horse. And basically every one of the stories had this story in which somebody was being oppressed, somebody was being abused, somebody was being robbed from. And then suddenly this amazing individual on the white horse rode in and he saved the day, and then he would end by kicking the front paw of the horse in the air and say, "Hi ho, silver away," and it would always end with these words, "Who was that masked man?" I think that's what Luke wants us to ask. Who is this man? We're going to continue through Luke chapter 8 and into Luke chapter 9, and we're going to be confronted with that. Who is this man that can calm the waters? Who is this man that speaks to the spirits and they obey? Who is this man that speaks to the dead and they come back to life? Who is this man? And there's only one answer that works. This man is God. As we close, let me just share a couple quick thoughts, and then we'll gather around the table. The first thing that really struck me as I was going through this is that the storm the disciples were in was a direct result of obeying Jesus. If you spend any time watching the Christian TV shows, I get discouraged often because it seems as if one of the predominant ideas that fills so much of what's on television today is this idea that if I obey God, if I believe in God, if I give money, preferably to them, the result will be God will make my way easy. He will give me the things that I desire and I will prosper. I will have wealth. I will have many things. And if I'm going through storms, it's because I have somehow not done what God expected of me. But that doesn't line up with the Scriptures. The disciples were in the storm only because they obeyed. They were in the middle of this horrific storm because Jesus had said, "Let's go," and they said, "Okay." And as you go through the stories, you will find many times where God's servants were in the midst of horrific circumstances because they were following God. Paul would be beaten mercilessly numerous times because he was following Christ. It's true that Peter was set free from jail. But you'll remember the day before Peter was set free from jail, James, the pastor of the first church in Jerusalem, was beheaded. As you study through history, assuming that tradition is correct, all of the apostles eventually died a martyr's death because they were following Christ. Christ does not promise storm-free lives. What He promises is to be with us in the midst of the storm. Jesus was on the boat. He didn't send them out and said, "You guys have fun. I'll see you if you make it." He was laying right there. And the reality of the Christian life is that Jesus is with us in the midst of the storm. Secondly, God is bigger than any storm. I don't know what you're going through, and I don't know what you will be going through. But there's an incredible reminder of God is greater than any obstacle. But finally, the answer to all of life's storms is faith. We live in a world in which faith is becoming popular again. We, for the last couple centuries, have been in what's often is called a modern time in which we have looked to science for the answers. But the younger generation is beginning to realize science doesn't have all the answers. It can't account for all of the problems. And there is an increased movement in spirituality, in faith. The recognition that we all have to have faith. This morning, you had faith. You believed that you could drive your car here. The roads were snowy. What guarantee did you have that the person on the other side wasn't going to spin out of control and slam into your car at 55 miles an hour? Or worse yet, what guarantee did you have that they didn't want to kill you and intentionally slammed into your car? I would guess most of us have some money in the bank, maybe not as much as we would like, but most of us have some money in the bank. You read almost every day of banks foreclosing, of banks collapsing. What guarantee do you have that your money will be there? Well, the government guarantees it. For how long? And what happens if the government decides to devalue your money so it's not worth anything? You still believe. I would hope most of you this afternoon are going to eat. Some of you will go out to eat. Others of you will go home to eat. Have you been in with that food every step of the way from when it came out of the ground to on your plate? My guess is probably not. How do you know somebody didn't poison that? How do you know your waiter didn't like the way you looked and is going to poison your food? You trust people. See, the question is not, do we have faith? We have to have faith to live. The question is, where is your faith? When the storms of life are so intense that you realize you have no power to control your life, you have to choose. Who will I believe? The question for all of us this morning is, where is your faith? Is it in the God of the universe who sent His Son to die on the cross to bear your punishment? Or are you still saying, I got this one?